This episode is supported by Active Skin Repair. Active Skin Repair is a skin health company helping people heal with natural, non-toxic, medical-grade ingredients. I just randomly, Vinny was having a toe skin irritation issue, and he ended up having this like skin that was really irritating him, and it was getting kind of like icky, and you know, like when kids start to get like little scabs and scratches and then they want to pick at it, and it was getting worse. And so Active Skin Repair showed up on my doorstep as a result of the sponsorship, and I got to put it to use immediately. And I got the ointment formula, or the like ointment formulation, and then also the spray, and the spray was perfect. So Vinny does not like ointmenty, creamy, lotiony things on his body, but I was able to get out the spray, literally took it out of the packaging the day it arrived, put it on his toe before he went to bed. And the next morning he was like, "Mom, my toe's all better." It was literally like this super amazing cure that helped his toes so quickly. So you can use Active Skin Repair on a wide range of skin issues, including cuts, scrapes, burns, sunburns, rashes, other types of skin damage. It's totally safe, non-toxic, suitable on all types of skin, even parts of the body where you might have rosacea or eczema or have acne-prone skin. This is also safe for the youngest members of your family up to the oldest. So now you have one simple solution for your family's skin health needs. With over 500,000 happy customers and thousands of five-star reviews and super safe and clean ingredients, Active Skin Repair is something that you want to have on hand for your family. So to get your own Active Skin Repair, go to activeskinrepair.com to learn more about Active Skin Repair and get 20% off your order when you use the code SHAMELESS. That's activeskinrepair.com. Use the code SHAMELESS for 20% off your order. activeskinrepair.com, code SHAMELESS. This is the Shameless Mom Academy, episode 869 with Melissa Bond. Show notes for this episode, including any links mentioned in the episode, can be found by going to shamelessmom.com and clicking on episode 869. Welcome to the Shameless Mom Academy. I'm your host, Sarah Dean. I'm here to give you and other passionate, driven, unapologetic moms stories, tools, resources, and a little bit of humor to help you lead more powerful, positive, and purposeful lives every damn day. So let's dive in. Melissa Bond is a narrative journalist, poet, and matriarch to Salt Lake City's slam scene. The Salt Lake City Tribune and the New York Post have both done features on Bond's book, Blood Orange Night, her memoir about becoming dependent upon and then withdrawing from benzodiazepines. Blood Orange Night was published by Simon & Schuster in June 2022 and was selected by the New York Times as one of the best audiobooks of 2022. Bond has been featured on PBS Story in the Public Square, Radio West, the podcast Risk, Endeavors, Psychology Unplugged, the New York Times podcast, and Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. When I heard about Melissa's story and her book, Blood Orange Night, I knew I wanted to have her as a guest on the show. This is a story that needs to be told for many, many reasons, in terms of medical negligence and just things to keep an eye out for with your doctors and red flags with medical professionals, but also in terms of a story of what can happen to a mom when she's in a really vulnerable situation, as we all are in those early stages of motherhood when we are struggling in so many ways and sometimes have no idea how much we're struggling because the struggle is real for so long, it just starts to feel really normal. So listen in to hear Melissa share how a very common medical prescription for insomnia led her to full physical dependence on benzodiazepines that led to her rapid physical and mental downward spiral. How she was able to begin to put the pieces together again around her unforeseen medical dependence after narrowly escaping harming herself and her daughter in a fall. Her discovery that her myriad of strange mental and physical health symptoms were actually her going through medication withdrawal every single day. Her decision to confront the doctor who massively overprescribed benzodiazepines to her. How the benzo-harmed community relates differently to common terminology around addiction. How the shadow of shame impacts people's recoveries from substance use, substance dependence, and substance abuse. And her advice to moms who are mentally or physically suffering with the demands of motherhood and how they can get help from medical professionals in the most safe and trusting ways. It's a hard story to listen to, but also it's a treat to listen to Melissa share it. And so I'm so honored and grateful that she was open to coming on the show, open to talking about Blood Orange Night with us, open to sharing her story, because this is a story that needs to be heard as many, many more stories, just like Melissa's, are invisibly existing out in the world without people having the platform to talk about them. So my hope is that this story and what Melissa has learned will help someone else listening who maybe is in a similar situation, or just raise awareness around the benzo harmed community and what can happen when you're at the hands of a negligent doctor. So with all that, please join me in welcoming Melissa Bond to the Shameless Mom Academy. Melissa, welcome to the Shameless Mom Academy. I'm so excited to have you here.
Oh my gosh, I'm thrilled to be here with you. Thanks.
This conversation has been a while coming, and so I'm really excited that we finally get to have it. But yeah, just in our little pre-con or pre-interview here, I know that while we have talked about addiction in various ways on the podcast before, one of the things that's already jumped out at me is how it's so different for every person. And it's so different for you than anyone else we've ever talked to on the show. And so I think this piece is going to be really, really helpful to our listeners and really insightful and help people see just kind of this full spectrum of what life with substances, sometimes taken fully as they are prescribed, what that can look like and how that can upend one's life in ways that you never saw coming. So Right. Welcome.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm excited to talk about that too, because that was something that took me completely by surprise. And I too had kind of a singular definition of addiction and didn't have all of the nuances that we're going to talk about. So I think, yeah, it's juicy for sure.
Yes. So with all that, I'd like to always ask folks when we get started about the dynamics of your personal and professional life beyond your bio. And is there anything you're really excited about right now?
Oh my gosh. My life is so rich right now.
Yay.
So first of all, this is part of the juicy part. I met the love of my life a year and a half ago. And that is just, I can't even describe. So my life is incredibly rich in that capacity. And all of these things that I've kind of wanted to do that you've needed a partner is happening. And so that's really fun. He also, because of his support, one of the things you and I chatted about a little bit beforehand, it was that, so with my withdrawal from benzodiazepines, I got down to 5 milligrams of Valium. This was back in 2013 actually is when I got down there. And I could not get further. I would try to just do this liquid titration where you're just doing like microliters of tapering, and I would have severe withdrawal symptoms. And I was full-time mom. I have a son with special needs, and I just could not get further. So I did what is called a long hold. I didn't know it at the time. I thought, well, maybe I'm getting a divorce. You know, all of these like life stressors were happening. And I thought, okay, maybe in a year, maybe in 2 years. I ended up holding for it will be exactly 10 years. And in part because of the support from my partner, I am currently tapering the last 5 milligrams of Valium and doing exceptionally well, which blows my mind because I was having seizures and a stroke and all kinds of things before. So that's what's exciting to me right now.
I mean, that's a lot of big life stuff right there.
Yeah.
very exciting. Thank you for sharing that. So in your memoir, Blood Orange Night, you describe the challenges of parenting a newborn and navigating your second pregnancy. And anyone listening who's been in that scenario, like one teeny tiny with another teeny tiny on the way is just, it's so much. And you were struggling with extreme insomnia. So can you describe this experience and what that was like, the toll that it took?
Yeah, it was nuts. I mean, I've had, you know, throughout my life, I have had nights where I'm up for a couple of hours or, you know, interrupted sleep. And I, you know, this is what I call the chamomile tea insomnia, where you have a couple of nights, maybe they're crummy, but this was truly an autonomic disruption. So we found out later that my cortisol, which is your fight or flight hormone, was just like spraying out at like 9 p.m. at night. So my adrenals had sort of flipped their timeline, and my wake up and go hormone was being shot out at 9 o'clock at night. So I would be getting ready. It was about, I think 2 weeks into my second pregnancy, my pregnancy with my daughter. And I felt like there's this scene in Pulp Fiction, and I'll describe it just in case your listeners haven't seen Pulp Fiction, where there's someone who has, Uma Thurman, her character, has like overdosed on something, probably heroin. And John Travolta shoves this huge needle, it's very dramatic, of adrenaline into her heart and like pumps her heart. I sat up and I felt like I had had this dramatic injection of adrenaline. I remember like sitting up and felt jittery, went out to the couch, and I thought, wow, you know, pregnancy hormones are really intense. You know, this is,
yeah.
I know what's going to happen. And I watched the night go from like dark to light. I watched the clock tick down, and I truly don't believe I slept that first night at all. And then each night subsequent, it was like an hour, maybe two, maybe a half an hour. And this went on for throughout my first trimester. I was really close to a psychotic break. I could wow. barely function. And I had a 6-month-old with Down syndrome.
Oh my goodness. You know?
So I would think to myself, okay, I remember there was one time in particular, I thought, where did I put him? You know, like put him on the bed. Did I put him on the bed? Like he was up for a nap and I'm running around the house panicking. And of course I had put him, you know, in his crib, but I just was so, anyone who has gone through severe insomnia knows that you lose your cognitive ability, mm-hmm. your body starts to break down. So that was happening. And finally my nurse midwife put me on Ambien with Benadryl. And she was like, that should be safe for the baby. And that was pretty awful, but I got 4 to 5 hours of sleep a night. And then Ambien is very close, but it's not similar to benzodiazepines, which is what came later. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of what started off this whole journey for me. Yeah.
As someone who has struggled with insomnia for decades and decades, since I was like 8 years old until I was 40, when my son was like 3, when I finally was like, I need medication. Like, don't give me melatonin. I don't want your tea. Like, so I relate to that feeling of being wide awake in the middle of the night, that feeling of like, you go to lay down in bed and you're like, your brain is like, let's start the day.
Right.
There's 18 things to worry about.
Right.
But also that feeling that you mentioned, and thank you for mentioning, like not remembering where you put the baby. Yeah. I remember doing errands when my son was really young and my sleep was really poor, and like coming in from the grocery store and having to consciously think, wait, did I bring the baby in from the car?
Yes.
And then thinking, I'm the worst mom. Does everyone wonder if they brought their kid in from the car? So that cognition, and I think that sometimes, you know, there's spurts of that when you have a newborn where you've had a few rough nights, but when you have that long term, and I had it for a few years into my son being born, it takes such a toll. And there's days where you're like, it just feels normal to be so mentally exhausted that you're just like, I'm fine. This is just normal for me. But then there's moments where you're like, maybe this isn't normal. Like, maybe I shouldn't forget where I put my child. Yeah, that's not, that is relatable. So yeah. Thank you for sharing that part. When your route in seeking medical support and then medication support, that's not an uncommon situation where you talk to your doctor's like, let's try this. And I went through this where the doctor's like, let's do a trial of 3 different things, see which one works. And I also want to point out that like Ambien is supposed to be the thing that works for everyone. And you said it gave you 4 or 5 hours because that's what it was like for me. And I was like, I was expecting 8.
Right.
But 4 to 5 hours also felt like 10,000% better.
Right.
45 minutes.
Right.
So it wasn't like huge for me, but I kept experimenting with things. So that's a normal sequence of events to try medication and see what happens. Can you talk about what then happened as you're just following doctor's orders and things shift from you being able to get more sleep to then being physically very, very dependent on these drugs?
Yeah. So one of the things that I didn't know, and this is something that points to a lot of the fractures in our medical system, I did not know with Ambien, you should not cold turkey it. This was never communicated to me by my nurse midwife, nor any other doctors. And so I thought my insomnia was hormonally induced because I had never had insomnia to this degree before. So I was like, oh, good. I will deliver my child. My hormones will return to normal. And, you know, just made a very like cognitively impacted decision to just stop taking the Ambien once I delivered my daughter. Not a great idea, but hadn't had any medical consult otherwise, you know? So I cold turkeyed Ambien 3 months, you know, and of course you get rebound insomnia, your brain, because it's had these drug really, really plugged into the GABA receptors, which the GABA receptors are what I call the hush neurotransmitter. They're the ones that are the inhibitory neurotransmitter in your brain. If you don't have it, you've got a lot of excitatory. So there's a lot of activity going on and there's no like flagging happening of like, okay, we need to calm things down because she needs to sleep. So I have rebound insomnia. 3 months later, I am losing my squash entirely. I have two infants, one with special needs. One of the things that had happened earlier, which part of what provoked the insomnia, was I had lost my dream job, which was working as an editor at a magazine. You know, I loved it. And so all of a sudden I was like the Betty Crocker CEO of the household. And I did not feel ready for that. I had not planned on that. And you know, everything, my whole identity was sort of an upheaval. So I go to this doctor who's a doctor, an MD, but also really interested in allopathic and oriental forms of medicine. And his whole website is like, we get to the root cause of disease and only use medication sparingly. And I was like, great, this is perfect. I'll be on both sides of the fence. I don't want medication, but I want to find out what's happening and I'm desperate. So he, in the first appointment, says, it sounds like you're in adrenal failure. We've got to get your adrenals back online. We'll do a test. But in the meantime, so you don't have a psychotic break while you have two infants, I'm going to give you this sedative hypnotic. It's a great drug. I know a guy that's been on it for 19 years with no problem. You don't have to worry about getting addicted to it and you will sleep. And that, those were like magic words. Like, yeah, it's not addictive. It's not going to hurt my child. And I will sleep. And that was the beginning of the end, really, because he prescribed Ativan, which I later found is in a family of drugs called benzodiazepines.
My mouth is like hanging open. Yeah. I worked in a psychiatric hospital.
Yes.
Like that he would say.
Not addictive.
Right. Wow.
Yeah. So we now know the FDA says these drugs are addictive within the space of a week. Like your body, and by addictive, I mean, there can certainly be psychological dependence because there's that fear factor that happens if you're an insomniac where you're like, oh my gosh, am I going to sleep tonight? Am I going to sleep?
Tonight? Yes. Yeah. Very real.
Yeah. There's also the physiological dependence where if you stop taking it, then you have at best rebound insomnia. At worst, you can have severe withdrawal symptoms. And they don't really know why. Some people can take it for a short period of time and be fine. And some people take it for a short period. And by short period, I mean a couple of weeks. And some people have extreme withdrawal symptoms. And by extreme, I mean seizures, tremors, lack of coordination, a feeling, flu-like symptoms, all the way up to like fatal seizure. And so I was prescribed very, very high dose and escalating dosages every night by my doctor. He said, take it every night.
Wow.
Yeah. And within 6 months, I had lost 20% of my body weight and was literally practically disabled. Like I could not walk a block. I was having a lot of breathlessness. I couldn't remember anything from one day to the next. I was in the black pit of despair. And I was like, wow. Motherhood really takes a toll. You know, that was the only thing I could think of.
Yeah. My experience with Ativan, when I worked with children in a psychiatric hospital in my first career out of college for 7 years. And in that 7 years, the only use that we had for Ativan with the children was when they were so highly agitated that they were a danger to themselves or to others. Yeah. And we would give it to them basically to help them take a nap, to like help them, like, so it was very infrequently given, but it was like, take a nap, and then they would be like a shell of themselves for like the next 12 to 24 hours. And so when you talk about like not being able to walk a block or feeling like you're in this black hole, like, I mean, yes, that's what Ativan does. This is, I'm just so shocked that your doctor was like,
it is a pharmaceutical hammer. Like it takes you out. And he, so I was initially prescribed 2 milligrams, which is the amount that they shoot you up with if you've had a grand mal seizure in the ER. So 2 milligrams was my starting dose. Within 6 months, he had upped my dose because the efficacy had gone down so quickly. He had upped my dose to 6 milligrams every single night, all in one shot.
Wow.
Which is almost criminal, but I've heard it this happen far more often than I can even believe.
Yeah.
But I was a very, very high dose.
This episode is supported by Mysteries About True Histories, a podcast for your kiddos. So from the creators of the hit podcast Who Smarted and Netflix's Brainchild comes the adventurous world of Mysteries About True Histories, affectionately known as MATH. Every episode follows Max and Molly, who have just been recruited into a secret order of problem solvers, on an adventure through time packed with puzzles, hidden equations, history, and laughs, making learning cool. This podcast is perfect for ages 6 and up, and new episodes drop every Thursday, each stacked with so much laughter that your kiddos won't even realize how much they're learning. I love a show where, as a parent, you're like, hey, let's listen or watch this or whatever, and your kids are thinking they're like getting extra device time or what have you, and you're like, they're learning right now. So it feels like such a big win. So I want you to go check out Mysteries About True Histories wherever you listen to podcasts. You can tune into Mysteries About True Histories with your kids. You can follow and listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, wherever you're listening to this podcast. So go check out Mysteries About True Histories to listen in and have some fun with your kid while they learn today. This episode is supported by Nutrafol. Did you know that hair thinning will happen to approximately 1 in 2 women? If you're among them, you are not alone. Thinning hair is normal, but it's not openly talked about, so it can feel lonely and frustrating and sometimes even embarrassing when you're going through it yourself. Join the over 1 million people who are doing something about their thinning hair with Nutrafol. Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist-recommended hair growth supplement, with over 1 million people seeing thicker, stronger, faster-growing hair with less shedding. Oh my gosh, I am a heavy shedder, so if you are a heavy shedder, or if you are someone who's wanting to thicken your hair, I definitely want you to try out Nutrafol. I have loved using it myself, and I know multiple other people have used it and have found great results. While many supplements rely solely on ingredient studies, Nutrafol clinically tests final formulations to ensure their efficacy. In a clinical study, 86% of women reported improved hair growth after taking Nutrafol Women's Hair Growth Supplement for 6 months. To get started, you can take their hair quiz on Nutrafol.com, which will give you a personalized health plan based on your special root causes. Nutrafol is committed to helping you identify root causes of any shedding or hair loss so that you can really start to rebuild healthy hair in a way that is customized to you. So take the first steps to visibly thicker, healthier hair. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter the promo code SHAMELESS. Find out why 4,500 healthcare professionals and hairstylists recommend Nutrafol for healthier hair. Go to Nutrafol.com. That's Nutrafol.com, promo code SHAMELESS. Nutrafol.com, code SHAMELESS. So how do you, were you able to pinpoint, like, maybe this is the medication that's making me like, how did you then put this all together?
Yeah, I think it took me down so quickly. Mm-hmm. And my cognitive capabilities had been diminished so quickly. Plus, I was not sleeping well. Plus, I was being, you know, full-time mom to 2 kiddos. So I was really hampered. And unfortunately, in a relationship with my now ex-husband, where his own trauma kind of came up and he shut down. So I didn't have any kind of reflection or support from him because he didn't understand what was happening. So I think the only thing that kind of saved the day was that I had such an extreme, you know, I was having really extreme symptoms, but then one day I was taking my daughter, I'd given her a bath. I had picked her up, was toweling her off and walking her to her bedroom. When all of a sudden I took a step and it was like my legs were water. I just immediately fell like a dead body from a bridge and almost smashed both of our heads into a corner wall.
Oh my gosh.
And I was laying there and I thought, okay, I've been dismissing all of these weird like GI and neurological symptoms. Like I couldn't eat because my stomach would cramp up. And I'd never been a poor eater. Like I'd always been like, give me the banana bread, please, you know? So it was really weird for me to be super skinny and not able to eat and not able to like walk a block. I'd been a marathoner, but I dismissed everything as like, well, gosh, you know, I've got 2 infants in denial. You know, I just didn't know what to ascribe it to, but I'm laying there on the ground with my infant daughter. And I think I've got a brain tumor. Like that is the only, all of these neurological dysfunctions, you know, I had a lot of like sensory issues going on. And I thought, well, maybe I have MS. This is how it starts, right? You have all these like weird neurological things. And then my legs came back after about 45 seconds. And I thought, wait a minute. In the last, like, what was it? This was about a year at this point. I was like, I've been taking this medication and the doctor said it was safe, but I have always been a researcher. And it's the one time I didn't research because I was so debilitated. I just thought, give me anything. Mm-hmm. And I went up and started doing my research and I found out everything I was experiencing was considered active withdrawal from the drug. So it meant
you were withdrawing, like you were taking it at night, but by midday the next day you were going through withdrawal and that's what was giving the symptoms.
Yeah. That's what was so wild to me was that it processes through your body so quickly. It's the new generation of benzodiazepines. So that I was having interdose withdrawal. So during the day, I would be in withdrawals. During the night, I would take a big dose and I would get maybe 5 or 6 hours of sleep max because my body was reaching tolerance so quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. So did you go to the same doctor to discuss your research?
No, I was horrified. He'd also been very inaccessible. Like I tried to go to see him a couple of times and he had been like in Costa Rica. He was for some reason had gone to Costa Rica a lot. And I luckily had a friend who said to me, I have a doctor who is amazing. She's very much old school doctor, like really believes that like she's this friend of mine had said this doctor had come and done a house call. Mm. And so I checked in with this doctor, went to see her. And I had at this point in my research found something called the Ashton Manual, which is written by Dr. Heather Ashton, now deceased, but is one of the only manuals on how to get off benzodiazepines effectively without, I mean, and when I say effectively, I don't mean without withdrawal symptoms, but I mean without suffering a fatal seizure or psychosis and hopefully being somewhat functional. It's a very, very, I call it the Olympics of drug withdrawal because it is so prolonged and so intense. I had found that and I brought that to see Dr. Kate and started working with her. She had never gotten anybody off of benzodiazepines, which was really interesting. She said, oh, we are very good at putting people on drugs, but not as good at getting people off. So she didn't quite know how to get me off. And we tried for about 5 months, were unsuccessful because my withdrawals were so severe. And then I spent another 2 months looking for an expert. And that's when I found a guy that was able to help me get down to the 5 milligrams that I got to.
Wow. I have a lot of feelings about this doctor that goes to Costa Rica.
Yes, right.
I'm sure our audience is wondering, and I am too, like, was there ever accountability? Did you have conversations with him? Was it just kind of a move on, I need to take care of myself situation? Or did you ever have follow-up care or conversations with him to let him know what had happened?
I love that you're asking this question because everybody asked me that. And while I was in the process, I felt so fragile.
Right.
And so focused on like, I've got to just get myself healthy. Like I felt like it was kind of terrifying to think of going to his office, telling him what would happen and truly like the fear of being gaslit or of him, you know, dismissing it, whatever. So it wasn't really until the book was published in 2022 and then we published the paperback in 2023. And my editor prior to that said, hey, we'd like you to add a new chapter. Will you add a new chapter? And I said, of course, you know, what do I want to add? And I thought, what is the one thing about the process that is unfinished? And I was like, oh my gosh, I never confronted Dr. Amazing. And I thought, am I strong enough to do this now? Because he could blame me. There's a lot of blaming of patients, you know, when patients say, hey, this medication is having horrible effects. But I decided to do it because I thought, he's still prescribing. This guy, maybe no one has ever confronted him. So the last chapter in the paperback is the story of me actually coming to his office with like a little Christmas gift, sitting there with my heart racing. Like
my heart is racing.
Yeah. And like, he comes out and he's got this Florida tan and he's like, hey, his bright, shiny smile. And I'm thinking, you know, it's Salt Lake City. I live in Salt Lake City. I know him. You know, we both used to write for the same paper. He wrote a healthcare column. And I thought, there is no way he doesn't know I've written a book. But I said, did you know I've written a book? And he said, I had no idea. So the last chapter is about me confronting him. And then what happens?
Oh my gosh. Okay. So now everyone just has to go buy the book.
Exactly. Did you see that teaser? That was me.
I love it. No, I love it. I love it so much. I so appreciate and respect that you could recognize in the time, in the thick of it, that this would just bring on more trauma to like have to manage that piece then.
Yeah.
But also the healing for you, I'm hoping, assuming, on like deciding to go back to that much, much later. I mean, that's such a big and bold step that you could have overlooked, but that you chose not to. And it's like in service of giving your readers more for this paperback release, but also hugely in service of yourself.
Myself and perhaps him. Like I thought, before I went, I literally went through this exercise with myself. I thought, okay, if I'm going to go meet him, I have to be able to step into that room. We decided to meet at a tea house. Mm. I need to step in there viewing him as a human with flaws and complexities that of which I'm unaware. And the metaphor that I use is this Hindu goddess whose name in Hindu I can't pronounce right now, but she's called the Never Not Broken Goddess. Mm. And her strength comes in the fact that she is always breaking and then always reconfiguring. And I thought that symbol is so true of what it's like to be a human. We are being broken all the time apart by various things in our life, and we're becoming a new self all the time. And I thought, okay, I can't go in there just wanting to blame him and tell him how awful, you know, what an awful experience I had because he did read the book. Can I go in there and really say, you've read the book. I've said what I have to say. Tell me what you were thinking. Mm-hmm. And how do you think about these drugs now? Mm-hmm. So that part was really healing. And I think impacted his practice, which is huge.
Oh my goodness. What a great bookend to your experience. So when we were talking before we hit record, you were talking a little bit about this experience of being on Valium now for 10 years. And something that was really interesting that you said to me was that in the recovery community, people have a lot of ideas and some people have very firm and rigid ideas around what quote unquote recovery quote unquote should look like.
Right.
And so I would love to hear if you could share a little bit, because I think this is also a part of addiction that we miss a lot, is that recovery can look like a lot of different things and what serves one person might not serve someone else. And I think there can be a lot of, you know, there's a lot of judgment around addiction, but there can also be judgment around recovery. Can you talk a little bit about, you mentioned being on Valium for 10 years now, what has that been like over the course of 10 years? And can you speak to maybe what that has been like in terms of recovery communities or conversations that you've been in?
Yeah. Oh, that's such a great question. I love the way you framed it because it is true. And I talked with this woman who was doing a recovery podcast and she said, I don't really understand this whole, I can still be on a little bit. She said, to me, that's like somebody who is a drinker saying, oh, I can just have a couple of scotches at night and I'm fine. You know, so in the addiction, and by that term, I mean substance use disorder. So the way I describe addiction at the way we use it in this culture is when someone has like compulsion and a craving to use and repeat of substance, you know, and to such a degree that it impacts their lives negatively. That's the typical description of addiction. When you have something that is a physical dependence that is has only come about because of prescriptions from your doctor, there's not that compulsion element. There's just a physical dependency that takes a long time to like, to kind of wean your body off of it so you don't have these terrible withdrawals. So in the addiction community, I think getting to point zero is kind of, I think their belief system is that your life is ruled by the substance because of the compulsion. And therefore getting to point zero is really important. That's my understanding of their perspective.
Right.
In recovering from physical dependence, there may be a point at which for me definitely happened, I could not physiologically get off the drugs without having like constant tremors and seizures. I could not get below 5 milligrams.
Which is terrifying.
Right.
Like, I can't imagine deciding like, okay, well, let's try it again. Hopefully I don't have a whole bunch of seizures. Like, right. That is such a scary decision.
It was terrifying. And at that point, I was a single mom. I was working full time. I'm supporting my kids. I've got a son with a disability. It was not something that I could step into. And my body at that point was not suffering. Like, I wasn't in decline. Because to give your listeners perspective, so I ended up being on 6 milligrams of Ativan, which is the equivalent of 60 milligrams of Valium. So I tapered 55 milligrams of Valium in about 2 years. And those were 2 years of active drug withdrawals. Like I would drop, I would have all kinds of withdrawals for about 5 days. I would have about 3 or 4 days where I would feel sort of okay. And then I would drop again. Oh. That is exhausting.
Yes.
Especially when you're raising two kids.
Yes.
And I couldn't imagine even trying to do that and hold a job, you know, and make sure I paid the bills and make sure I got, you know, drove my kids to soccer practice and did all those things. So I talked with the doctors that I was working with at that time, and they said, you know what, 5 milligrams, we are not sweating that. You are not in decline. Your memory is fine. Like, we're not worried. I'm fine. My addictionologist said, I'm fine if you're on that for the rest of your life. So I thought, maybe I will be on this much. Maybe I will never be able to get off without suffering such intense withdrawals. Mm-hmm. So what I am finding now, and in the community, in the benzo harmed community, there are some people that also feel, no, you have to get completely off or you're like cheating or something like that, mm-hmm. which I think is just kind of as you said, I think is rigid and is not really, doesn't really fit with what we know about some people's bodies. Just those drugs lock in and they're like fish hooks. And if you try to pull them out, you will tear things apart.
Yeah.
And so the long hold for me has been a time of great stabilization. I think my neurology has really, I've been able to excel in my career. I've been able to write a book, you know, my kids are doing great. And so that has been really healthy. And it's gotten me to the point where I decided, you know, I'm ready to taper off the last five. And I think if I had continued trying way back then, I think I just would have suffered and my kids would have suffered.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. This episode is supported by AquaTrue. Having clean, safe water is the last thing you want to worry about. But unfortunately, according to extensive research by the Environmental Working Group, 3 out of 4 homes in America have harmful contaminants in their tap water. So that's why you got to check out AquaTrue. AquaTrue purifiers have a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers, which is what we have, take no installation or plumbing, and they remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. And they're specifically designed to combat chemicals like PFAS, which can lead to potentially adverse health effects like cancer, endocrine system disruption, and liver toxicity, which is part of what makes AquaTrue so special, unique, and important in terms of how they are able to filter water. They also have water purifiers to fit every type of home. So like the installation-free countertop purifier that we have at our house to higher capacity under sink options. They even have Wi-Fi connected purifiers and mineral boost options. So I'm so excited about our new AquaTrue. And here's the thing. I swear it's like a gentle reminder to actually drink more water every time you walk into your kitchen. So we are drinking more water now and also more clean water. So more water that is more clean. It feels like a double win. I'm feeling pretty impressed with us. I feel like sink water, tap water becomes invisible at a certain point. And when I see the purifier on my counter, it's like many time a day reminder to like, keep drinking. So I want you to check out AquaTrue for yourself and for your family. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money back guarantee, and that makes it a great gift as well. Today, my listeners can receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier when you go to AquaTrue.com. That's AquaTru.com and enter the code Shameless at checkout. That's 20% off any AquaTrue purifier when you go to AquaTrue.com and use the code Shameless, S-H-A-M-E-L-E-S-S. AquaTrue.com, code Shameless. This episode is supported by a podcast I want to share with you called Understood Explains. So this show is about navigating ADHD, dyslexia, and other learning and thinking differences, which can be so confusing. And so every season of the show is around a different theme. So there's a season on special education, there's a season on ADHD diagnosis for adults, and the current season is all about IEPs. I love this podcast because the episodes are 10 to 15 minutes long. So if you are short on time or short on focus, you can take this content in super quickly, easily. It's very digestible. And the show is hosted by teacher and special education expert, Juliana Urtube. So Juliana talks all about how to navigate educational plans, IEPs. She talks about the differences between IEPs and 504 plans. She really breaks things down in a really clear and simple way so that you have some of those questions that you might be thinking around, like, does this pertain to my child? Is this something I need to be looking into? Like, where do we go from here? Where do I go if I have questions? Juliana has you covered. She explains so many different things and so many different little pieces and nuance of IEPs and special education and different things on Understood Explains. So I want you to go check it out wherever you're listening to this podcast. You can go listen to Understood Explains. Just go into your podcast app, do a search for Understood Explains, and it will pop right up. Click on it, pick your episode, and get the answers that you've been looking for and the support that you need around different learning differences and differences in school. I think it's so interesting that I'm equating this to alcoholism as like something, because I feel like that's where people's brains might go to say, like, okay, so you have struggled with alcohol addiction or alcohol abuse disorder, and so you're just going to have two drinks a day for the rest of your life to keep that at bay. And what you're pointing out is that this category of benzodiazepines, it's different. It's apples and oranges. So yeah, it's not saying like have two drinks a day for the rest of your life, because you know, if an alcoholic were to do that, the way that that disease progresses is they can't do that.
Right.
But the way that this disease progresses or is allowing you to be in recovery and be stable, it just looks different. And I think that that's, when we think about addiction and we think about people in recovery, I think that's where we can have a little more curiosity and compassion.
Yes.
To have deeper understanding that like those aren't the same things, but because I think alcohol addiction is so more prominently talked about, referred to, it's maybe what we've more seen in our own personal lives and family structures and things like that, that it's easy to kind of make that comparison. And it's not an accurate comparison.
It's not accurate. And the thing that I will also add is that for me, whether we're talking about addiction or physical dependency, the thing that kind of overshadows all of this, that is part of our cultural lexicon, is this shadow of shame.
Yeah.
I think, you know, that shame is so toxic to people's recovery that I really, even though I make the distinction, you know, I was not addicted, I did not have compulsion. However, those that are addicted, because some people do become addicted to benzodiazepines. I have a dear friend who became both physically dependent, but he also became an addict. He started using it because he was like, oh, I feel so much better. And I liked it. My friend, Matt Samet, he wrote a book about his benzo recovery. He was using it to be able to do a lot of rock climbing that was really hard because it would chill him out. That's addiction. It was compulsion. He was not using it for any kind of medical reason. However, when we layer shame on top of any kind of challenge that we suffer from as humans, like people don't want to become addicts. They don't want that compulsion. There's something that compulsion is filling. I think we miss the boat if we, like, I want to make the distinction, but the shame is not good for anyone. And that's what I think we really need to pay attention to.
Yes. And thank you for calling that out so explicitly. Yeah. I totally agree. I'm wondering, when we think about, and you've also, I really appreciate you discussing the difference between, or the nuance between, addiction and physical dependence. When you think about being someone who is physically dependent because this doctor prescribed this to you, and then like you, now your body is in this extreme state of dependence, was for sure back, you know, at the time that you started to taper down, but still has some level of dependence. I'm curious how you and people in this similar situation, and you said the benzo community, I think is what you said, which like benzo harmed community, I think were your words. How do you all relate to the addiction community? Like, do you consider yourselves, or and maybe it's a, you know, personal choice kind of a thing, but do you consider yourself part of the addiction community, or is this adjacent or a subset, or can you share that a little bit?
Yeah, it's a really tricky one because what this is why I talk about the issue of shame, because I found that within the benzo harmed community, there was a lot of reactivity when people would use the term addict. They would say, I am not an addict. This is something that was prescribed by my doctor, and I just took it as prescribed. And now I am suffering immensely. I am not an addict. And that points to me to their experience of being labeled in a shameful manner, like their moral compass had gone awry. And while I think the distinction is important because we need to be able to treat those people, whether an addict or someone in physical dependency, the treatment modalities will be different. There will be different ways that you address it. I think making the distinction because of that sense of shame is missing the compassion we need to have, that people simply suffer and the way they address that suffering is different. So I think I'm a little different in the benzo harmed community. I think most in that community that I'm aware of really push back against the addict language. Yeah. And they don't want that language. They actually, I had an organization that refused to support my book because addiction was a term that was in my book. And they said, we absolutely cannot endorse your book because of that. And I felt as though they had missed the larger conversation.
Yeah.
So the distinction is important. So I guess I would say for most of the community, it's adjacent because it is a recovery. But it's, we have such, there's this cultural anvil of shame that exists over the addiction community. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's something that needs to be addressed. And because of that, I think the benzo harm community is adjacent.
Yeah, that makes so much sense.
Yeah.
I want to go back to the beginning a little bit to ask a question that can help other women and moms, whether it's related to insomnia or other medical issues. If you could go back, or if you were talking to a new mom who says they're really struggling with insomnia, what would your advice be now? And what do you want people to know? Because it's not an uncommon experience to go to your doctor and say, especially in early motherhood, hey, I'm really struggling with this or that. And when your doctor gives you a solution, you're just so grateful and like hopeful and looking forward to support.
Yes. So yeah.
You absolutely did nothing wrong. But is there anything you would have done differently or you would do differently now?
Oh, absolutely. So I do feel like I did everything I could. I mean, I went to every single doctor under the sun. You know, I saw a therapist, I saw a nurse practitioner, I saw a sleep clinic doctor, I saw a naturopath, I even saw a shaman. You know, I was like, okay, what I would say to a new mom, and I'm so passionate about this because we celebrate motherhood, and yet at the same time, a lot of mothers do not get the support that they need.
Yeah.
One of the things I realize now is that my insomnia was a response holistically. There's a new brand of doctors and they call themselves functional medicine doctors. And they're basically doctors that look at the whole picture holistically. They're sort of what we really want doctors to do.
Yeah.
If there is a way to look holistically, what are any kind of things that have impacted your life beyond having the kids? What is your relationship like? Like, I mean, I had lost my dream job. I was suddenly in a role in a very, very kind of toxic relationship, you know, which I was trying to make work because, you know, this is my new husband. I've got two infants. But if there's any way, like getting psychological support, trying to take a holistic look, like what's impacting my life? Like, if you think of yourself as a planet, like what are the things that are like hitting this planet right now? And when you go to your doctor, do your best to do research on the medications they prescribe. And I say this knowing that I had always been that person until I was really, really compromised. And insomnia can really compromise you. So if there is maybe somebody else that you can check in with, because there are a lot of, if you go the pharmaceutical route, there are a lot of things that are far less damaging and less addictive, you know? So think of it as like a toolbox. For me now, there's a wellness toolkit that I use because sleep is still an issue. And I will use those things which do the least harm first, you know? So for me, I have community supported acupuncture. I make sure yoga, I make sure my diet is spot on. I make sure, you know, all of the things, good sleep hygiene. but also just having real compassion for yourself, because being a new mom is one of the hardest things in the world. Your whole life is changing. Your identity is changing. Mm-hmm. And your life surrounding it, you know, could be changing. So having counsel with somebody else that you really trust, and then trying to do your research, and a lot of compassion.
Thank you for that. Yeah. I joke with friends and also with my doctor about my medical degree from Google University. Every time I go to the doctor and I'm like, oh, I'm a little bit worried about this thing over here. And the doctor's like, well, you know, that's fairly normal for, you know, you, your age, whatever. Yeah. And I'm like, well, I just wanted to make sure it's not any. And then I have my list of like five things. Right. These five things that are on Google, because it could be any, like, should we screen for these?
Right, right.
And I'm like, now I'm like, prepare to roll your eyes. I brought a list.
which if they are a good doctor,
yeah,
they will say, yes, I want us to be engaged, like, because if you don't feel comfortable, and you have to trust yourself, you know, and you also have to like know that you're with a doctor that you trust. Dr. Amazing for me was a new doctor. I didn't know how trustworthy he was. I just was sort of, you know, going for it based on what I saw on his website.
Yeah. I haven't worked specifically with a functional medicine doctor, but I've worked for years with a naturopath who was also my midwife. And one of the things that stood out to me at the very beginning of our care, and that has now any of my friends who I get to confirm an MD to an ND, or doctors that do both, because there's definitely doctors that have both background, they are always blown away by how an appointment, typical appointment, goes from like 15 minutes with an MD, medical doctor, to like 60 to 90 minutes with an ND, naturopathic doctor. Yeah. And I think that that allows you to build that relationship, allows you to build trust, but you have like full on conversations about so much broader context of your life, which you mentioned. And that really, really shifts the kind of care that you get. And that's been a huge game changer for me. And I always like to mention that if you go to an MD and ND, just making sure that you're in a place where you really feel seen by whoever your care provider is, and continuing to search till you find that person.
And I think also being aware that a lot of the MDs right now are really, they are being squeezed really tightly by the insurance companies. Yes. So they're being pushed to get in as many people. And then with each diagnosis, they have to have a code for a diagnosis. And then the insurance companies will pop up the kind of medication to treat it. Right. So their ability to treat the way they want to a lot of times is severely compromised.
Yes. Yes. So yes, my comment was not intended to be like bashing of the medical doctor community. It is the constraints. Let's bash the insurance industry. That's where we really need to.
It's systemic, you know?
But even when I was working in psych 25 years ago, for children to get medication, they had to have a diagnosis. And in order for them to get a hospital stay, they had to have a diagnosis. And for them to get more days added, they had to get diagnoses added. So like, we got a lot of kids who needed 21 days just to medically stabilize, and they could only get 21 days if the doctor diagnosed them with ADHD and ODD, something, which is oppositional defiant disorder. So there was this massive influx of kids that we got who left a hospital with this diagnosis, because that's what got them 21 days of medical care covered by insurance. Right. And these were people that couldn't pay out of pocket for 21 days of hospital care. Right.
The system.
I'll stop us before we get, that's a whole other interview.
We can both get on the soapbox here, but.
I know. Yeah, Melissa, tough. This has been so fabulous. Can you tell people, where can they find you? Where can they find Blood Orange Night and all things about you?
So my website is melissaabond.com, and my Instagram handle is @melissabauthor. Those are the two best places that I'm really active. And then you can find my book. It should be in local bookstores. It's on Amazon. Really easy to find. I do recommend getting the paperback, because that has the additional chapter, which I feel like really rounds out the whole story. It's a nice ending. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I mean, everyone needs to know now. Everyone needs the paperback to get that chapter. Find out, what did the doctor say? What did Dr. Amazing say?
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Melissa, for everything that you're doing, and to support people within the benzo harms community, but also to add awareness and create more empathy and compassion for people who are experiencing this, because it's not nearly as uncommon as people might assume. Yeah. In addition to that, can you tell people how you're currently showing up as a shameless mom?
Oh my gosh. How am I currently showing up as a shameless mom? My daughter is 14, And I've become the sex educator for her and all of her friends.
Oh my gosh. I love it.
They come to me. They're like, I say, okay, I will answer your question. I do in my head. I'm like developmentally appropriate. I'm a big advocate of like proper sexual education.
Yeah.
So my daughter is apparently the one that everybody comes to when they have questions.
Love it. I love it so much. That's so great. I don't feel like anyone else in almost 500 interviews has said that before. So you can really wear that one with pride.
Great.
People are always like, what do you want me to say for that question? I'm like, whatever comes to mind. So I love that that's the thing.
My daughter's like, I know everything. And I was like, great. I would rather you hear it from me than from the internet.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
And then
I love it.
Talk to her about the sacredness of sex and all that, you know?
Yeah. I love it. Yeah. Oh my goodness. Okay. So I will link everything in the show notes. If people go to shamelessmom.com, click on the episode with Melissa Bond. We'll have everything linked for the book and Instagram and Melissa's website. Thank you for being here. I appreciate you, Melissa. And when you write the next book, you got to come back.
Oh, absolutely. Yep. It's a plan.
Thank you for joining me in the Shameless Mom Academy today. It is always a pleasure and a total honor to be in your ear. Please make sure you are subscribed to or following this show on whatever podcast platform you're using. This ensures that you never miss an episode. You can find everything related to the Shameless Mom Academy at shamelessmom.com. And you can inquire about my speaking, consulting, and coaching services, where I help women leaders, small business owners, and organizations build thought leadership and communication confidence over at sarahdean.com. That's Sarah, no H, SARADEAN.com, sarahdean.com. Until next time, know that I appreciate you so, so much, my friend.
Well, hey there, busy mama. Are you looking for ways to make your life easier, your home less chaotic, and at the same time, add more joy to your life? My name is Deanna Yates, and I'm the host of Wanna Be Clutter Free, a podcast all about letting go of the stuff we don't need in our lives so that we can focus on what truly matters. Don't worry, I'm not going to tell you to throw it all away or make you feel guilty about keeping something you love, no matter how many other people don't quite understand it. But I will give you practical and, more importantly, actionable advice so that you can make progress right away. And you won't just hear it from me. There are amazing guests too. It's like having your bestie in your pocket, telling you it's okay to let go of the things that are not serving you and your family in a totally non-judgmental way. So join me over on the podcast where we can work on progress over perfection for those of us that want to be clutter-free.